This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Kelly.
How are you?
I am freaking awesome, as always.
I love to hear that.
Thank you.
I want to get that printed on a t-shirt.
I'm freaking awesome.
Maybe that'll be our first merch.
Oh, that should be ours first. I'm freaking awesome.
Yeah, I'm freaking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. How are you?
I am good. I'm very good.
You're good. You're good. You're very good.
Yeah. I mean, it's Friday. I'm a little tired. I'm ready to go home and take it easy after this.
No way. After this, we've got an exciting episode coming up, though, that we got an awesome guest.
We do. We do.
Yeah. You can kick back after we're done with having our conversation with an awesome guest. How about that?
Yes. Actually, I think I have a Zoom meeting or something with a client after this, but later. Anyway, today we have Josh Patterson with us.
We do.
Back with us. He's the host of the Rethinking Faith podcast.
Yes.
And you're going to be at Theology Beer Camp, right?
Oh, of course.
Yes.
You are.
I will be there.
In October. In addition to his podcasting and ministry, Josh is also a beer aficionado. We'll all be at Theology Beer Camp, which is hosted by Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be some of the podcast guests there. And mm-hmm. there will be other speakers, and there will be lots of different craft beers, even some non-alcoholic options.
For snacks. People like me. Yep.
And Eventbrite is where you get the tickets for that. And I know we're probably competing with you, but we have a discount code for people who want to.
Are we competing with Josh, though, in Rethinking?
Well, I think he's got his own discount code.
Oh, okay.
I did, but it's your show. Drop your code.
our code, the secret code on Eventbrite to get $25 discount on the tickets is Radical Hobbit.
That's a good one.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
That's right. Can you just picture him? Uh-huh. You know what that hobbit looks like?
Yeah. And especially when you think about Trip. If you don't know what Trip looks like, just go to his website, Trip Fuller. It's TRIPPFULLER. You'll go, oh my God, he does like a hobbit.
I was going to say, is the implication here that Trip Fuller is a radical hobbit?
Well, if you look at
I think that's going to be his favorite compliment he's ever received in his life.
Yeah. The poster for this year's, Theology Beer Camp, there's a Lord of the Rings theme or like kind a return of, yes. I think it's Return of the King. I keep saying it's Lord of the Rings, but a real Lord of the Rings fan would tell me no, it's actually Return of the
at that level we don't know the difference, so right. But well, welcome Josh, it's good to have you on, man.
Yeah, it's good to see you both again. When did we hang out?
February.
Jeez.
Yeah. In a couple of months. Yeah.
In a couple of months.
It has been. It's crazy.
So we met Josh on a panel that we did where it was hosted by Trip. He was the facilitator, I think is a better word for it, that was asking podcasters. So you were on there along with Tim Whitaker and Kelly and I, and the question was basically about our podcast spiritual communities, and that was the basis of that. And this was at an event about God after deconstruction, so give full context to how we met you and why we were there and everything else. It was definitely exploring faith outside of the boxes and God after deconstruction. So,
yes. Right, and then the God after deconstruction has now yielded a book.
Yes, they
so
have.
So that conference was, it was Trip Fuller, it was Thomas Ord.
Yes.
And Jonathan Tabinel spoke. Catherine Keller was there.
Yes.
And some other folks. But it's now yielded a book that is out on Amazon and other places that you buy books.
Yeah, wherever you buy your favorite
God
book.
After Deconstruction. Yeah, it goes down the list of all these top reasons why people are leaving churches, leaving religion altogether, and takes on these tough questions. So it's really, it's a very good starting place for people who are kind of religion curious or like, maybe I'll make my way back. Yeah.
Well, and that's what you're doing, Josh, with your podcast. So how long have you been doing Rethinking Faith?
Oh, geez. Rethinking Faith turned 5 in October. However, I don't remember how many months ago was October, but however many months ago that...
7 months. We'll go with that. That sounds good.
Yeah. So like, I guess about 5.5 years.
Wow. Well, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. It used to be called Theology Doesn't Suck. And then it got got rebranded to become Rethinking Faith. But yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah. So tell us why you started it.
Okay. So why? I started it with a buddy of mine named, I don't know if they want to be named anymore. I started with a buddy of mine. You can find out who that is if you go listen to the first episode. But what we were trying to help facilitate is that you could have theological conversations across the aisle, so to speak. So my friend was, still is a very conservative, like Westminster Confession, regulative principles of worship type Presbyterian.
Wow.
And yeah. I am not that.
Right.
I wasn't quite into like process and open relational thinking, you know, like I was like I am now then, but I definitely was a different flavor of Christian than him. And so we wanted to have meaningful conversations about different theological topics. And it worked for a bit until it didn't. He ended up stepping away from the podcast because he didn't think it was a good look for him.
Yeah.
So the neighbors would think.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
that's where we started. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. And then from that point forward, I think you did mention when we were together at God After Deconstruction, you've had a couple of co-hosts before, but it just seems like the show is just naturally you, right? Josh doing the Rethinking Faith. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I had two, other really great co-hosts. My buddy Marty, who I met working in a church together. He was the worship pastor. Him and I did like 100-some episodes together.
Oh, holy smokes. Okay. That's some serious. All right.
Yeah. And he ultimately ended up getting a job in a church that did not look favorably upon the podcast. And so they're like, well, you can do the podcast or you can work here. And so it's like, you should probably, help provide for your family. So that's why Marty stepped away. And then I brought on a buddy named Greg, who was an Episcopal priest and kind of like spiritual director type person. And we had some fun together, but ultimately Greg made some pretty big life changes, even like including vocational changes, and just decided it was best to kind of step away. And so I've just been rocking solo ever since. But seems to still work out. People still listen, so I guess that's good.
Yeah, it looks like you broadcast a lot. I've been following your podcast, and I see new episodes come up pretty frequently. So,
yeah, you have a regular cadence, yeah?
Yeah, I try to put out an episode once a week on Wednesdays.
Yep.
And sometimes, you know, I'll do more than one episode a week if I have something extra that I want to get out. But yeah, typically about once a week. So, and I have a lot of episodes backlogged right now. So I have probably 6 or 7 episodes in the gun ready to,
to
go, you know.
Good for you. Yeah. Good for you. Well, that's what I love about you, dude. Seriously, you, and just in that, spending that time we did, at the event itself, like maybe you should give our listeners a little bit of, background and context of, you know, your story and why you are doing what you're doing. So how about we start there, actually?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So when I started podcasting, I was a pastor. I was working in vocational ministry. And I don't do that anymore. So there's a story there. The first church I ever worked at, I experienced you know, the quick of it is I experienced, and I don't use these terms lightly, but spiritual, emotional, verbal, and borderline physical abuse at the hands of the head pastor, my boss, and also the founding pastor, the boss of my boss. And that led me to leave that church. I was there for only 8 months, and it was 8 months too long. Yeah. So I left and took a job at a Methodist church. I started podcasting at the Methodist church. So the first, that bad experience didn't turn me off from the church per se. It just kind of made me think like, oh, well, maybe just like that church sucks, but you know, this next one will be fine. And for the most part it was, but it also had some pretty significant issues. And ultimately I ended up leaving that church after about a year and a half, and to move back to Maryland, which is where I live now. These churches were both in Florida. So we were away from friends and family, which was, you know, added kind of to it. A lot of positive things happened there, but also, like I said, a lot of negative things. One of the most positive things that happened when I was there, where it was the first church that I worked in that was open and affirming. And the worship pastor at the time, my buddy Chad, was an openly gay man. And so that was the first space, like first church I worked in where that was a thing. So that was really cool. And then I went to my next church back here in Maryland. And I was there for, I think, almost 2 years and ended up, you know, essentially going through the process of deconstruction. It started when I was at the Methodist church, kind of kicked off by some of the church hurt stuff, but then also some questions I was asking. And really, I was going through that process while I was on staff as a pastor, which had its own, you know, difficulties. And I ultimately, with the help of a spiritual director, discerned that I should leave vocational ministry. And I became a bartender after that.
Wow. So, ministry of its
indeed it is. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so all that to say, that's kind of my background in there. And so rethinking faith has been with me along the way.
Yeah.
So you, in a way, like you could, you know, with the risk of sounding like self-aggrandizing or something, but you could go back and trace the journey of Josh Patterson. Just by listening to the episodes, because really the show has just been that. I'm talking with the people I wanted to talk to, asking the questions I wanted to ask. And it's just been this 5.5 year journey that's continues today.
Wow. That is, that's brilliant, actually, because that's not self-aggrandizing at all. You simply just captured the questions that you wanted to seek out and recorded it. And so, you know, the world out and is, it's out there for the world to listen. Your experience, because you know, especially you bring about, you know, deconstruction. Oh my God, that word, you know, it's so used now. And when I started mine, I guess about 11 and a half years ago, that I'm sure that it was in the vocabulary somewhere. I didn't know. I just knew that I had to deal with the bullshit that I had picked up much younger in my life and had messed me up for so many years and caused the issues that it did. And then I was in sobriety and I had to, you know, figure out what I was going to do with it. So call it what it is. But I am grateful for whatever word works. I think everybody should have, be careful how I say this. There is value of doing this because it ultimately has deepened my faith. Can you say that for yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I would think so. I too can be weary around using the word deconstruction, just because it's become almost like a pop kind of word, and which is fine. I don't want to take that away from anybody, but at the same time, it can mean something different. So yeah, I don't know. It's just, for me, I just look at it as like spiritual growth.
Or, right, right.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe hopefully maturity. I don't know. You can ask my wife if she thinks I'm mature. But something like that, you know. I don't know.
Well, we'll get into you.
Yeah, call her up. She'll say, "Hell no."
He's still a kid. He's a man, yeah. Child.
Basically.
But it's, you know, I mean, it's there. There is a a biblical basis for the idea that the faith that you have as a child or as a young person is not going to be the same when you get older. When you think about, you know, Paul or somebody writing as Paul said, you know, when I was a child, I thought like a child. Now that I'm a man, I think like a man. Mm-hmm. And I still only see things as though they're through like a dirty mirror.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is going to be that process.
That's very true. So I'm going to ask you a completely off the wall question. Do you, in your faith, do you see yourself as a mystic at all? And do you enjoy the mystery, or where do you find your faith? Is it something that's more finite and more clear to you?
Yeah, I absolutely love the mystics. My introduction to the mystics came through some of, you know, the more popular Christian mystics, like Saint John of the Cross and Saint Teresa of Avila.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like that, Martin Laird, Thomas Merton, Richard Rohr, Cynthia Borgio. And so that really helped me, the, you know, kind of mysticism, the experiential aspects of faith, the, you know, the more, like, I guess you could call it negative theology at times when it's, you know, we can't really say anything positive about the divine. Those things are very, very helpful. And I still love the mystics, and it plays a big part in my faith. Yeah. And I mean, I think it lets me hold uncertainty a little bit better, because for me, I'm a very like head focused person. When Greg was on the podcast, we used to talk about the three centers of knowing a lot: head, heart, and body. Yeah. And what the mystics have helped me do is move out of my head and into my body, if that makes sense, and into my heart space.
Absolutely.
And so it's a different, for me, it's a different aspect of my faith, a different way of holding it. Because I still love the head stuff. Like, I just recorded an interview this morning about trying to harmonize the work of Alfred North Whitehead and René Girard. So process philosophy and mimetic theory. Nerd stuff.
That's nerd stuff. Good for you, though.
But at the same time, the mystics is often where I return. So I don't know.
So I am so glad I asked you that. Because I am I'm a self-proclaimed mystic, and I don't want to put hubris to it, but you know, it's like I'm not scared of using that word, and because I feel like if more of us would, you know, come out of the closet as mystics, you know, we would show what happens in our own faith. We demonstrate it, right? Because you just said it, that to get out of the head, I'm like you. I am very much in my head, but my faith lives in my heart. It lives in my body. And I need the mystery to, and the meditation and the process of getting it to drop down into me, because otherwise I'll keep it up in the headspace. And that's not where it really belongs, because, you know, after all, God is love, or the divine, whatever you call it. And it's really hard to love from your brain. You got to love from your heart space. It's as really kind of simple as that. And that's the beauty of mysticism and the mystery of it. And, but then also for us mystics, we also learn to be comfortable with uncertainty. And as you were just saying, you know, looking into a very, you know, opaque mirror that's not like, oh, I don't see back out. Yeah, well, that's just how it goes. But yeah, so that's more of an observation, I guess, than a question in there for you, Josh. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I agree with you. Mysticism has been helpful in that. It's like I don't know, posture is the word that keeps coming to mind. Like kind of the posture that I take, approach that I take. But to your point about like the whole deconstruction thing, and spiritual growth and stuff, as a process person, I reject the idea that fundamental reality is made up of static things, substances, and instead see reality as event-based. It's the most truest aspect of reality is that it's becoming, not that it's being. And so for me, faith to be static, one, it can't exist, but it's dead. If it's not becoming, if it's not moving forward, it's dead. So I just have to reject the category of a static faith.
Amen, brother.
It doesn't fit in my metaphysical scheme. Talk about, see, now we're going to the nerd stuff, out of the heart into the head.
But isn't this, it? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, this reminds me of, you know, I get teachings from everywhere and not always from places that I expect. Yesterday, I was driving down the road and I was listening to the U2 radio station on Sirius.
Okay.
XM. I'm an old U2 fan, you know, youth group in the 90s. And they were interviewing a physicist, Milton Gleiser, okay, who is a co-author of a book called Blind Spot, which is the subtitle is something like How Science Cannot Ignore the Human Experience. So it's these scientists getting together and saying, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? Look,
oh,
he's preaching, holding the book.
He's holding the book up. And there you are.
You're killing me. You're killing me. But yeah, and he was talking about all kinds of wild stuff as I'm driving along. He's talking about how we don't even really know how to define life, how one-celled organisms are somehow it's matter that can detect stimuli around it and respond to it. Like an amoeba knows there's some sugar over there, so I need to move over to it.
Yes.
But he brought up the ancient quote from Heraclitus, you know, back, you know, 800 years before Christ, was that statement of no man ever steps in the same river twice. Because the river's moving.
Right.
And the human has changed.
That is correct.
And that was kind of a long way around to get to this whole idea of the dynamic.
That faith is static and that there's no done.
Everything. It's always moving. And so, you know, and then you think about, you know, bringing quantum theory about how that the same electron can be two different places at the same time. And you don't know where it is.
Right.
So yes, that was a great product placement though.
And we called them up, like, you know, but
you guys we'll have to tell the authors of the Blind Spot that they owe you money.
That's right. You just got to plug.
Yeah. Yes. And visit our website.
So Josh, why do you have the book?
I mean, cause it intrigued me. I mean, the title, The Blind Spot, Why Science Can, cannot ignore human experience. So experience is big for me as a mystic. But also I saw a friend of mine, Dr. Andrew Davis, post it. And normally when Andrew posts books, they're worth reading.
Well, there you are.
And it is. It's really good. So their concept of the blind spot is analogous to what Alfred North Whitehead calls the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And so they're doing processy type work in the book, which is pretty cool.
So,
and I do need to correct myself. It's Marcelo Gleiser. I think I got it mixed.
Yeah, you said Milton.
I got
Marcelo Gleiser.
So, Josh, I love the fact that we're nerding out here for a minute. And you brought up something I think hopefully it would be interest to our listeners as well. So, although being nerdy can be a little not everybody's cup of tea.
His phrasing, the fallacy of misplaced concreteness.
I love that. So break that down now for simpletons like me.
Yeah. So basically Whitehead is saying that in philosophy and in science, we fell into this, we've made a grave mistake where we have taken abstractions, our ideas about reality, and then treated them as if they are something more than just an abstraction. So we've taken our ideas and made them concrete. Which is a failure to recognize that, no, they're abstract. And so it's done a lot of really good stuff for us. Like science is amazing, right? Like we're using quantum physics right now to have this conversation. I don't know how it works, but the microphone's doing a thing and the screen and all this kind of stuff. It's excellent. It's wonderful. However, there are blind spots that science can't see because it's based on abstractions. And so it's deeper than that. It gets into the idea of like, can we trust our experience or not? It gets into how we understand consciousness. It's like this whole big thing. It's really basically it's metaphysics, our understanding of how our conception of how the world works. And so Whitehead was saying like, we need to be careful that we're not taking our abstract ideas and treating them as if they are real, basically. That was long-winded. Sorry.
No. That was great. Because I flip it this way then. When we look at, you know, the things that the three of us do, right? We explore our faith, and that's what we share through our respective podcast, how we live our lives, so the things we do. So when we look at what would be a more typical spiritual experience is going to be with an institution, is that not exactly what has happened? Is that these are abstract concepts that then become concrete, that become the institutions?
Sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I think sometimes they literally become concrete.
Yeah. And yet, isn't faith abstract by its very nature, right? Because when you think about the oneness of it all, and that's the word I use, right? It's something I can't comprehend. It's incomprehensible to me anyway. So therefore, it will always be abstract. But if I'm okay with that and I don't try to make it concrete, then I'm going to live at peace with it.
Mm-hmm. Who was it? There's a mystic, and he would do this prayer where he'd say, God, rid me of God. And what he's praying is basically he's saying, like, don't allow me to worship my abstract ideas of you, because they're just that. They're my ideas. And so, yeah, the God rid me of God. Now I'm going to have to look up. I want to make sure I can credit this individual. But that's a prayer that I pray often.
It's the idea.
Yeah, it's Meister Eckhart. I should have known.
Of course, that would be something he would say, right? Yeah,
don't make even your image of God an idol. The idea that if you think that you've got God figured out, you're whatever it is you figured out is not God.
It's not God. Which, okay, now I know so little about Islam, but you know how they don't have any images of Muhammad, right? Or not of Muhammad, but of God, right? That's absolute heresy. Mm-hmm. Of any imaging. Is it in that same space that whatever it is beyond our comprehension, but it's so holy and so sacred that, like, you cannot make an image of it?
I think so. I think it's a natural extension of the commandments against idolatry.
Right.
Is that it becomes any time we reduce God to something less than a mystery, that we've then created an idol.
Right.
And honestly, it prevents further growth and prevents further development, because once you've got God all figured out, then you don't need to figure anything else out. You're not open to further revelation.
Well, unfortunately, look how many of our soul siblings think they have it all figured out, or they're told that they've got it all figured out if they live their lives a certain way, mm-hmm. and have that certitude, right? Like this, if you do this, then you're going to be good.
Right. I prayed the prayer.
Got this. Yeah. I go to church.
I was just trying to find it, and I can't, so forgive me. But Whitehead has this really great bit about, like, basically dogmatism being an exhibition in folly. Which is another reason I love his framework, his process framework, is that it's just that. It's a framework, and it's meant to be malleable and flexible and can learn and grow with our experience. And so it's more of an invitation to try something on and see how it works for you, rather than this is the dogmatic, rigorous thing. So it's a bit more flexible.
That's well said. So for context, you studied open relational theology, yes?
So I did a lot by myself I'm currently working on a master's thesis where I'm using process relational theology and ecclesiology, but I plan on doing a PhD in it when I'm done my master's.
There you are.
Yeah. Cool. Can you, by the way, not everybody who's listening is going to know what process theology is or open and relational theology. Is there a short way of summarizing or at least giving like a top line view of the approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So open and relational theology is a phrase that was coined by an individual that both of you met at God After Deconstruction, Dr. Thomas J. Ord. And it's kind of an umbrella term to capture a pretty big group of people. But I can break it down by just doing the two words, open and relational. So open is making a claim about time. And it's saying that the future is genuinely open. It does not yet exist. So that's the open part. So there's going to be implications for theology in that, right?
And so then it's not like that predetermined, God has already set everything out and, you know, has predestined some people for this and predestined some people for that, et cetera.
Yeah. So it's going to be pretty much the opposite of that. The future is genuinely open. God experiences time with us, and we are writing history together with the divine. The future is genuinely open.
Yep.
And then the relational aspect is more so making a claim about God, namely that we can have genuine relationship with God. And in a way that is both internal and external. So what I mean by that is if I have a relationship with you two, you both are my friends. When I'm happy, you know, hopefully maybe that makes you happy. And when I'm sad, maybe you feel sad with me. In the same way that if, you know, something tragic were to happen, I would, you know, be sad because you guys are my friends. It's going to impact me, right? So the same too with God. We have the ability to impact the divine in the same way that the divine has the ability to impact us. So that's a claim about the relational nature of the divine. So that's kind of the umbrella. The future is open. God is relational.
What I was going to ask about is, you know, among a lot of the reasons why people have issues with Christianity and some other religions are when tragic things happen. The idea, you know, that that can be traumatic, that can be, you know, people are like, how on earth does God allow that to happen? And there's a lot of people who are just like,
I'm done.
There can't be a God.
Yep.
You know,
they check out on that.
Can't be a God. And, you know, and I think for me, one of the first entrance places into that, and I'll have to go back and look it up, that there was a poem that I read where it was somebody talking about, it was the death of a child or something really tragic. And somebody said, God mourns with you. I was just like, whoa.
God mourns with you.
What is that?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to put that idea out there and see if you can elaborate a little bit on how open and relational theology deals with things like tragedy.
Yeah, sure. So this is where it's going to veer off into a little bit more of Josh's interpretation of open and relational theology, because it's a broad category. And specifically, I'm of the process flavor. So it's going to be kind of a processy answer. But for me, basically tragic events, bad things happening was kind of the catalyst of why I found open and relational theology. And the move that open relational theology makes that I find compelling is that, you know, as opposed to determinism, where God predestined and preordained everything that happened, right? So even the Holocaust, God planned it. It was God's idea and somehow brings God glory. That's one perspective. Then there's people who would say that it's free will. And so, like, even though God didn't plan it, God allows it to happen because people have free will and God wants us to, you know, not be robots. Say, okay, but to me, if God could prevent genuine evil from happening and chooses not to, in my opinion, that's an indictment of God. God is culpable for the evil that God could have prevented but didn't. So what the move that I want to make is say, and in open relational theology, is that God cannot unilaterally prevent genuine evil. It is outside of the realm of things God can do. And there's a reason for that, and it has to do with the essence of who God is. I believe that God is love, big L, capital L, love.
Mm-hmm.
Love is inherently non-coercive. And because love is non-coercive, it cannot force. In my perspective, God doesn't take over our body and make us do something. So because of that, God can't prevent genuine evil unilaterally by God's self because of the nature of who God is. God is love. So it's not that God is weak. It's just that God is love and non-coercive. So instead, God experiences my pain and my suffering with me. God knows what it's like to be Josh Patterson, to have the Josh Patterson experience and experience my pain and suffering and tragedy. God is in it with me, and it grieves God. And God takes that suffering into the divine self in each moment of becoming. It doesn't overcome the divine. Rather, God valuates it. And then in the next moment of becoming, offers the next best possible thing that is good and beautiful and true. And so God is always trying to redeem suffering. Never the cause of it, but always trying to redeem it. Always. So hopefully, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds so much like being a parent.
Yes.
You know, and not, you know, because I, you know, grew up thinking about God as like the father. But the, like, you know, really stern, abusive father, you know, and I'm glad my earthly one isn't like that. But it sounds much more like the true experience of being a father. And that was one of the things that started my, I don't think you would call it deconstruction back when I started, but it was actually as a child thinking like, there's nothing that I can do that would make my parents abandon. Nothing. There's certainly nothing that, you know, like I could see them disciplining me, but I certainly couldn't see them disciplining me forever with no reprieve for no, you know, without any redemptive part to it.
Right.
And how could I be so arrogant to say these two imperfect humans love me more than God does? And then I started thinking about like, well, then what is the deal with God then? Like if God does love, then there's something in all this teaching that we got wrong somewhere along the way. And that started a whole process where it was less deconstruction, because I feel like deconstruction has some activity to it, more like the Bible fell apart in my hands. And I had to kind of pick all the pieces back up over the years. But anyway, that just that whole idea, the like it strikes the parent in me because now I know what it is to look at this person and be like, I'm just going to keep trying to make your life better, even if you step all over my toes.
Well said. Josh, thank you for that explanation, because that's really great. I do have a question into that. This is Mark's perspective of faith and oneness, right? So in open and relational theology, can I also see the oneness like that? We are God, God is us, and the oneness that comes through that. So is it, can I live in that space with that?
I do.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the, you know, short, you know, answer, but yes, I think so. So open and relational. Well, so now we're getting processy. So process, it was right. So Whitehead never called it that. Whitehead called it his philosophy of organism, because it recognizes the interrelated aspect of all things. So for Whitehead, the idea that there is an isolated individual it doesn't make sense. There's no such thing. Nothing in the universe is isolated. Everything exists in relationship to everything else.
There you go.
So the whole doesn't know itself without Josh. In the same way, I don't know myself apart from the whole. So everything is deeply interrelated. Also, most process people are panentheists or pantheists. Some of them are just straight pantheists. But for me, I currently ride in the panentheism camp that everything exists within God and God exists within everything. And then
like
also, yeah, right. And then I'm also a pan-experientialist, which has to do with like philosophy of mind. And the idea is that experience is ubiquitous. It goes all the way down. And this ties back in, Kelly, what you were saying about the interview with the blind spot. The smallest particles, you know, subatomic particles, even they have experience. I'm not saying they're conscious like you and I are, but their experience isn't zero.
Right.
And so then, like, as, you know, things become more complex, then something like consciousness can emerge out of that.
Yes.
And so, again, that's a deep inherent, you know, interrelatedness, interconnectedness. So that's the long answer to the just short yes.
And beautifully said. So for our listeners, let's go over those three words, because those are not really popular or, well, common phrases. So there's panentheism. Okay. Which you would define as?
I would say God is in the universe and the universe is in God.
Okay. Then there's pantheism.
Which just kind of makes God is everything. There's less of a distinction. It's similar, but there's less distinction between God and everything else.
There you are. And then the third one you just mentioned, which is a new one to me, and you're going to have to repeat it. I apologize.
Yeah, so pan-experientialism.
Wow.
Sometimes called panpsychism, but that word in philosophy world was kind of kicked out because people basically strawmanned it and said it was meaning something that it doesn't. But and so I prefer pan-experientialism, but that's kind of having its heyday right now in philosophy of mind conversations, consciousness studies, because our current worldview and perspective can't explain consciousness. Even the best neuroscience can't do it.
They can't. That's right. They can't.
And so pan-experientialism is an attempt to do just that. And it works quite well.
I love all three of those. And again, it's so great to have you on, because, you know, having these kind of nerdy conversations also shows hopefully to our listeners that there is this is what exploring faith is all about, right? It's outside of the box. Is that for the three of us to be engaged in this conversation, nowhere are we without our faith, right? Anything else, we've deepened this because we do this exploration. Unfortunately, though, I get it that some can't go where we are just fundamentally because of fear, if anything else. And I have family members that are like that, and I'm sure you too as well, and our listeners, that they must have the box, and the box that says it's okay to be inside this box. You step outside of this box, especially when you start talking about panentheism or pantheism, or
worshiping Pan.
Yes. Pan the pipe player, you know. Yeah, what?
You guys love Peter Pan that much?
Personally, I'm a Jeff guy. But,
yeah. Nice.
You know, it's I love these conversations. This is why we do what we do, to you know, it's okay to have these questions, like, because this is, you're getting to the mystery, to the unknown, and that this is enlivening, and you know, it steps it way outside the boundaries of what, you know, unfortunately, a lot of our religious traditions currently have the capacity to operate in. So,
which actually does bring up a question for me. And Josh, in your ministry background, or just like what you picked up along the way, how do you counsel somebody who is really uncomfortable with uncertain. Somebody who's just like, I can't stand it when religion is not neatly tied up or formulaic, or, you know, if I doubt one verse of the Bible, then I doubt the entire Bible. Or, you know, if there's some tenet of faith that is no longer, that's now mushy, I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. And that's part of, actually, that question is part of why I stepped away from vocational ministry, because I felt like I could unnecessarily cause people to ask the kind of questions that I was asking, and I didn't want to cause harm to anybody else's faith. That was never my intent. I've never wanted to take away anybody's faith. I've never wanted to undermine or deteriorate. that happened to me, and I would like that to not happen to people. So I've just tried to share what has been helpful to me. But in those situations, I really just, you know, I have friends like that. You know, I was talking to a buddy yesterday who's in that kind of place, and I just try to get really curious and ask a lot of questions and learn the why behind some of the things, right? So, for example, for me, I could just, you know, throw out hell, right? I don't believe in hell's a thing. But somebody could really hold on to that closely, and it turns out that, like, oh, there was a really tragic thing that somebody did to them in their life, and hell is the only way that they think that they're going to have justice in their life. So for me to tell them that hell's not real is taking away this, do you see what I'm saying? Like, this is an important thing for them. So being curious and asking, now I think hell is abhorrent, but that's not the point in a pastoral situation. You're trying to help somebody. So it's less about me telling them what I think and more about just being curious, being a listening ear, showing unconditional love and acceptance. And I think that you don't argue people into new ways of seeing things. You can love people into new ways of seeing things.
Yeah, but you can't argue them. You can't.
Yeah, you can build relationships with people and build trust with people, and then they're open to different things. So,
oh my God,
Josh, you can't argue people. I'm gonna be chewing on that one all day.
Yeah. Well, you can manipulate them.
You could try, but most of the, I mean, just empirically, data and studies show us that when you argue, so like say on Facebook, right? My crazy uncle posts something stupid that I think is crazy about his favorite political candidate. And I'm like, oh, Uncle Johnny, you're so dumb. How can you believe that X candidate is so great? Blah, blah, blah. What that does, it doesn't change his mind. It actually cements him further into his position.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so it's not a great way.
Not a great way.
People need to know that they're loved and accepted, not that, you know, they're idiots.
So there's a powerful lesson out of this, my friend, that I hope in the work that I do, that I follow in your path. And it's because I am not, you know, professionally trained seminarian or theology or pastoral care, I think is most appropriate here, is to apply the Hippocratic Oath here, do no harm. And I am going to be really mindful of that. I mean, I try to lead with love to the best of my ability in the conversations, and I definitely have evolved, but you're right. Just me saying something could very well be damaging, because who am I to use my position, like you said, to discount what they have. That's not how this should go. And that is you. And because of what you do, Josh, we need more of that. Because if you think where we are in our culture, in the conversations that we have, whether they're political or religious or any of that stuff like that, it's not based on just what you just said of just listening and honoring their belief. It is theirs just as much as my belief is mine. And it's holding that imbalance in honoring one another, that's where love can seep in.
Yeah, and I want to be careful too, because I don't want people to think that that just means that I accept everything. Like,
nope.
If there's something that's harmful, I'm going to call it out.
Yep.
Like, I don't think I'm going to be way less patient with somebody who's just espousing like straight up racist beliefs to me. I'm going to be like, no, you're off basis, my friend. Or people, you know, like, I don't know, people who are being homophobic or whatever. Like,
right.
If you're causing harm to other people, then like, that's not cool to me. And like, I'm willing to stand up for that. But, you know, it is easier to, I don't know, outside of that. I just want to make it clear that I'm not advocating for just being a doormat either.
Agreed. And thank you for saying that, because yeah. I think I want to circle back to something, because I do know a part of your story and your journey is the fact that one of your brothers is queer. And so you have motivation inside of that to be loving to your brother. And that's helped you in this journey as well. So if you want to add more to that story, because you did share a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, I have two brothers and a sister, and both of my brothers identify as queer. One of them is gay, and the other one prefers, if they're made to choose a label, pansexual. And so that's just a big part of my reality and experience. Yeah. And so that for me was never an abstract idea. Like, that, you know, if we're talking theological like arguments or something, mm-hmm. someone being queer was never just an idea for me. It was always an experiential reality. Mm-hmm. And so that experiential reality always kind of pushed back against any kind of theological things I was taught, if that makes sense.
Yep. Exactly.
And I think relationships do a lot for people. Like, I, you know, like, all right, for example, I always understood homosexuality because my brothers. But something that was harder for me to grasp was transgender folks. Not mm-hmm. in a way, not like in a hateful way, but I didn't know, I didn't understand. And I mean, ultimately, I came to the conclusion, like, I don't need to understand somebody to love them. That's silly. But stepped into relationship, and now I have lots of transgender friends. And that has really, that's helped a lot. Relationships do that. I think yes. Relationship and love has a way of, I don't know, humanizing people and things. And so, you know, for me, one of my rule of thumbs now is I often like to tell people, like, their friends or whoever that are throwing out transphobic rhetoric on the internet, like, hey, do you know any trans people? Have you ever talked to them? No? Well, then you should probably shut the fuck up, because you don't know what you're talking about. Like, go have a relationship, and then you can whatever. But so, yeah, I don't know. I think that's, again, just curiosity and openness. I think curiosity should be a spiritual discipline.
I agree. I love that. Yeah, thank you for saying curiosity. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So that's always, I don't know. That's my brothers and my friends.
Mm.
So,
well, Josh, unfortunately, we have to bring this awesome, awesome conversation to an end. I am so grateful that you dropped in and we shared some time. I really would love for you to come back. You just, you know, the love I have for you immediately was that weekend, just how you live your life so just out there so fiercely, that, you know, it's really, it's energizing. So,
yeah, really had a good time talking with you today, and with, you know, open and relational theology, there's so much to it. We really just skimmed the surface today.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, way a lot.
I mean, this is, I think, a good intro. Yeah. For you know, for our listeners, and you know, we've dropped the names of a bunch of books and scholars for them to follow up with, but I do hope that we can dig in a little deeper next time.
Yeah, most definitely. I would love that, and I'd love to have you guys on sometime too. Come hang out on Rethinking Faith. It's always a good
time. Fine. Let's make it happen.
So, I'll text you guys.
Please do. Listeners, our beloved listeners, we'll put this information, we'll put it in the show notes. So those books we were referencing and Trip Fuller and the Homebrew Christianity and the
Radical Hobbit.
Yeah, the Radical Hobbit. That's our code. That's our code. And all that other good jazz. All right. So, Josh, until we talk again, peace to you, brother.
Yeah, cheers. Peace to you guys. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to RadicalLoveLive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.